Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, Traditional Knowledge. What happens when worldviews clash? That's certainly a question facing researchers trained in the Western scientific method. Alberta is home to some innovative projects that seek to incorporate traditional and Western scientific knowledge. There's a fur bearer monitoring program that depends on the observations of native trappers. And the Sustainable Forest Management Network seeks to balance research based on the collection of quantitative data with the holistic relationships espoused by First Nations. And then there's the Science in a Crate program that highlights Aboriginal observations of nature as related to the principles of engineering and science. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Snow drops from the spruce trees as I walk the trap line with Walter Quinn and Mark Spafford. We're near Heart Lake, not far from Lac aux Biches in northern Alberta. Walter has been trapping in the area for over 40 years. And Mark Spafford, a biologist with Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, is keen to use Walter's knowledge of the area to gather data on how logging might be affecting the productivity of trap lines. We duck beneath the spruce boughs where Walter points out some of his snares.
It's because on account of the layout of the spruce, they're small, you know, and in small spruce like this in the muskeg, you know, you have a lot of rabbits, eh? And where you find rabbits, mostly you'll find coyotes or whatever other kind of animals you're trapping. And I pick out the lowest spot. I don't trap in the high spot unless I'm going to be trapping squirrels or whatever, eh? So I pick the lower spots of where I trap.
For the monitoring program, what would be some of the data that you would write down from this spot, for example?
For this spot, like for coming down here, I'd write down what time I left, what I came here for, and what I seen, what I just told you, what I seen. There was a lynx here, and that there was a feeding on a carcass, but no wolf, no fresh sign of wolf. So I'd write down, okay, there's a track lynx, and coming down here, there's a few coyotes, a fox, there's a fox. All that data would be put in the sheet. That's for today. We just started, and I'm telling you, we have lots to report if we go right through the trap line. I have about 60 wolf snares out, probably about 20 conny bear, and that's the farthest I'm going this year, eh? So whatever I catch, then I just put it under the sheet, hand it out to Mark, and he knows what he wants to see.
As Walter checks his snares, I question biologist Mark Spafford about the purpose of the monitoring program.
It's an innovative way that we've come across to incorporate some of the knowledge of Aboriginal and non-native trappers, and basically using them as our field technicians to look at the presence of fur bearers and also the response to these animals to disturbance such as logging, fire, oil and gas activity.
What's the purpose of including the Aboriginal trappers in this?
We feel we couldn't come up with a better trained staff to go out and collect information on fur bearers. These folks have been collecting or capturing and harvesting fur for generations. For us to pull a trained technician that could do the same thing in the same amount of time would be near impossible. So that we have these people in place, and they know the land, they know the cycles, and they know where these animals are. It gives us the best insight into the behavior of fur bearers, and also an opportunity to work with them, to let them understand what we're trying to do and how we're trying to work with them to come up with a way of harvesting trees and also promoting their livelihoods.
How is the program actually set up? How are you collecting data?
Okay. We have selected several trap lines. I believe we have 11 this year. And what we're looking at in these trap lines is the levels of disturbance. So how much of these areas are going to be cut by ALPAC or have been cut in the past by ALPAC or other licensed timber harvesting companies. And what we've done is cluster these areas so that we have areas of low amount of cutting or none adjacent to areas that have been cut maybe up to 15% of the trap line. And from year to year, what we'll do is we ask the trapper to go out and collect his information on his trap line and also on the disturbed areas. So we want them, even though they may not be trapping in the cut blocks, but to go out and visually examine these areas for tracks and evidence of fur bears in these areas. And if it so happens that they think it's worthwhile to trap in these areas, then we also ask them to record that trapping data to measure the amount of how many hours a trap needs to be set before it will catch a lynx in an area such as a cut block over an area of an undisturbed patch of spruce forest like where we're standing today.
What are some of the things that you've learned this year, for example, that tell you what's going on in the environment here?
I guess it's from year to year you'll have variation. This year, for example, there's an abundance of hare in certain areas, which again are a food base for some of your major predators like lynx and coyotes and wolves and foxes. And these are also a good an indicator of what these areas are capable of in a good year. So that if we turn around, we harvest this area, and 2 years from now, or maybe 7 years from now, and we see that there's an abundance of hare and no predators, then maybe there's been an effect or some kind of an association with the disturbance. But these kind of things we can't really tell until we do a sort of a long-term study. This monitoring program isn't just for several years, but it is going to continue throughout the existence of ALPAC's forest operations so that we can continually back-check on our progress and how we change our practice or how we're conducting our practice to see if there's a way we can do it better, to leave it more like a natural system so that the fur bearers are there for the trappers and the trappers can work with us to tell us if something needs to be done.
What have you learned from Mark in terms of collecting this data and that? What does it mean to you? What have you learned from it?
Actually, I've learned a lot. It's really exciting because it's in my kind, my line of work, and I've learned a lot because there's a lot of things I didn't understand about the Western scientific knowledge of how they done the studies and all that, and by that, I try to include what I know about how I lived in the bush all my life and trying to put those two together. I've learned that it's going to be much easier to work together because the both knowledges we have, everybody needs them, eh? And that's how strongly I feel about the program. And it's one way of helping out the trappers, you know. They like that very much. I mean, there's something for them to do every day. Like, they're all excited about marking down what they seen and what they got. I mean, nobody's ever asked us this question before in the bush, eh? And it's, like I said, it's exciting, and it's going to be a learning experience for me.
In the old days, Walter would take a dog team to check his trap line. But on this day, we drive and then walk. This next trap set near a frozen creek will make Walter some money.
This is a female fisher that was caught in a 220, which is a sort of a 7-inch conibear, square frame killing trap. Walter's just cleaning out his trap set area. It's basically a little cave he's made out of wood, and he puts a bait, typically beaver meat or rabbit meat in the back, and sets a trap in the front. The animal would enter the front of the set, and the trap would strike him on the back of the neck and kill him quite quickly. In the case of this fisher here, I got caught, and then it just rolled down the bank, and there it is in the trap. For the purposes of the monitoring program, we'd be able to mark down that this trap has been out for probably 3 or 4 weeks now, and that this is the first fisher, Walter. This is the first fisher that it's produced, and he's produced a female fisher. Female fishers typically have a smaller range than a male, so this is probably a home range for a small family here of fisher. And so that would all go into the monitoring data sheets that we see. And so that we would be able to see, we can track individual areas. If we say female fisher, we know that's a fairly concentrated range compared to the male, which may have three times the range of travel.
Loves the trap so much, doesn't want to let it go.
We check out one more set of snares on Walter's trapline. He calls this spot the place of the half links.
Right here, Carol. The last time I seen this snare, I caught a lynx, which was eaten in half by another lynx. So that tells me there's another lynx in here, might be more. But if I can remember correctly, years ago when my dad used to say that, when animals start eating each other, there's getting to be too many of them. So I kind of follow that yet. So I know there's a lot of lynx this year, and that's how I can tell by another lynx eating another lynx, is that, you know, I don't know what it is, but you don't often see that.
Are they impinging on each other's territory?
I think that's what it is, yeah. Like here we had a female with two kits that were around here, and the one I caught was a male, and the other ones that are eating it might be the mother with the two kits. I'm not sure, but there's tracks all over here. But for this year, that's it. I can't trap them anymore, eh? So next year, I'll have a little more. Yeah. Also got a wolf set over there, but looks like nothing went through.
Now, you say that there's probably a lot of lynx around. Why would that be?
Because there's abundance of rabbits, eh? Where you find rabbits is mostly where you will find lynx. And, like, this year there's a lot of rabbits, and even last year I noticed there was more, eh? There's getting to be more. But in each year, as you get more rabbits, then you'll get more lynx and other species, eh? Like fox, coyote.
On a trap line near Heart Lake, I was speaking with Walter Quinn and Mark Spafford, a biologist with Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Dr. Mark Stevenson is an anthropologist who has spent much of his time working with Inuit and First Nations people. As the director of the Aboriginal Research Program for the Sustainable Forest Management Network, it's his job to find ways in which two worldviews can come together, those of the scientist and those of the Aboriginal elder.
That may be, you know, a source of conflict for one who is, you know, thinks there's such a thing as absolute truth and only a single objectivity out there that that works for everybody. And that's not the way it is. The objectivity is something that all scientists aspire to but can never escape. They always bring their values, belief systems, own their biases and assumptions to their interpretation of real world phenomena. And there's no way to escape that. And it's simply not an issue, as far as I understand, for Aboriginal people who acknowledge, you know, their subjectivity, do not strive to be objective in all cases, but have a more sort of comprehensive view of the world. And another way of looking at it, perhaps, are the differences. Is in the systems of management, our culture, Western science, and its environmental resource management paradigm attempts to manage resources, and the knowledge and the information that counts in managing resources is often the knowledge that Aboriginal people don't have. They've been very good at managing something else, not the resources. What they've been doing, and I've had this told to me by Inuit hunters, elders, Nuchelnoth elders, Shuswap elders, all sorts of Aboriginal elders, that they do not manage resources. That's an offense against, you know, the Creator. That's an abrogation of their responsibility in the natural world, but what they do manage, and I've pressed them on this, and in subtle and inappropriate ways, what do you manage? I've asked them, and they've said, well, we've managed relationships, we manage connections, We can manage. That's what we can do something about. We can't do anything about the resources themselves, but we can manage our relationship and connections with them and our activities. Now, that's profound. That's a profound difference in the two systems, that we're managing two totally different things. And the knowledge and information that counts, okay, are in those two systems are fundamentally different. So in one way, but I would argue they're also complementary. There is some knowledge that I think for effective decision-making that Western science and its environmental resource management paradigm can contribute specific knowledge about the resource, specific information about the resource base, knowledge that Aboriginal people, for example, may not have in terms of numbers, quantities, things like this, whereas I think Aboriginal people and elders can contribute a lot about the relationship. That's the management unit.
What could we learn from that? What can we learn from traditional knowledge?
Traditional knowledge, or the knowledge that Aboriginal people have relied upon to sustain their relationship to themselves, with themselves, and to the natural world, it's a broad base of knowledge that looks just not at the resource. Man does not stand outside and above any species or any other species on this earth, but is in fact has a reciprocal or equitable relationship with other plants, animals. And when you sort of turn it around and the relationship becomes the management unit, then that opens the door for, and begs the question of what are we managing, right? Are we managing the resource base for what and for whom, right? Or are we managing the relationship? And this is where Aboriginal rights comes into it. You know, the issue of Aboriginal rights is fundamental to the issue of bringing and incorporating the knowledge of Aboriginal people and their values into decision making, into environmental decision making. And we have to be very specific and have a specific understanding that at the end of the day, these people may have a lot of rights to bring their knowledge, not trivialize their knowledge and force it into the environmental resource management paradigm of the dominant culture, but bring their own knowledge and systems of management to the table. The two-row wampum that was given to the Redcoats back in 1764, a year after the Royal Proclamation, reflected this concept of duality, of the two cultures living side by side, not jumping into each other's boats or canoes, but living side by side, but going up together in the same direction. That's a good model for co-management and the incorporation of Aboriginal people and their values and knowledge and management systems into decision-making with respect to the environment.
Can you give me an example of some of the research that's going on in this area?
Okay. The model we've been talking about is being applied, for example, in Shoal Lake, with the Shoal Lake First Nation and some researchers out of the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, and so far has been very successful in terms of buy-in from the First Nation community. Another example of research development that we're working on is between the Heart Lake First Nations and ALPAC, Alberta Pacific. ALPAC is now into variable retention logging, which basically opens the door for foresters and forest planners to work together with Aboriginal people, Aboriginal elders and trappers, land users and youth, to design forest cutting plans that incorporate the values that Aboriginal people want sustained and the values that that ALPAC want sustained. They're not necessarily divergent. And in a lot of cases, they want the same values, but there are specific values that the First Nation, Heart Lake First Nations, do want sustained that can be incorporated into forest cutting plans if you adopt that variable retention logging model. And so this is a prime example, a prime sort of on-the-ground example of incorporating Aboriginal people and their values and their knowledge into, for example, forestry.
What are some of the other areas that you would be trying to develop research programs in?
Here in the network, we have something under Dr. Cliff Hickey's leadership. We have a research initiative called the Sustainable Aboriginal Communities Initiative, and we're focused on four specific areas of research. Now, it took us a couple of years to develop this research program, and it took quite an extensive program of consultation with Aboriginal people and Aboriginal forestry experts across Canada. But finally, we've developed this thing that has or this program research initiative that has four specific priorities. The first priority is the one that we've sort of been talking about. Is the integration of Aboriginal people, their knowledge, their management systems and philosophies into sustainable forest management. The second priority that we have is research into accommodating Aboriginal and treaty rights into sustainable forest management. What issues need to be addressed under that research area? It's basically an open book right now. One of the ones that needs serious attention is the our provincial forestry regulations and whether they are in fact in concert with the fiduciary obligation of the government to Aboriginal peoples, whether they are an infringement of those rights, and if so, how can we fix that, so that provincial forestry legislation and regulation does not infringe Aboriginal and treaty rights, but actually accommodates them. That's an area of research we need to look at. Another area, a priority research area within the Sustainable Aboriginal Communities Initiative is looking at economic development and capacity development in First Nation communities so that they can effectively participate in the benefits, both the economic and managerial benefits of sustainable forest management. The fourth one is actually developing measurements, criteria, and indicators to see how well we're doing, our industry partners are doing at those other three things, and that'll hopefully tie in with other certification efforts. In so doing, we are preserving or providing a valuable service to the network and to sustainable forest management generally, because and specifically our industry partners, because we're giving them a leg up on the competition. Because down the road, it's conceivable that most of the public will only buy so-called green certified wood. And within Canada, that stamp has a significant and will have a significant Aboriginal component to it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I was speaking with Dr. Mark Stevenson, Director of the Aboriginal Research Program at the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Coming up, spiderwebs, 13 moons, and tipping teepees. What keeps a teepee from tipping in a strong wind? Why is a spider web so strong? And why do natives have 13 months in their calendar? These are all questions addressed in the Aboriginal section of the Science in a Crate program developed by the Science Alberta Foundation. Teachers use the materials in the crates to give students a hands-on look at what science is all about. Rhonda Elsner is an Aboriginal teacher who helped design the crates for Native children. And Anne Popwell is the manager of learning projects at the Science Alberta Foundation.
Well, this crate we're looking at in particular is called Ways of Knowing Structure and Design. So it, in particular, looks at structures, architectural structures, and so looking at how Aboriginal people use their knowledge of structure and designs, and then looking at the science that's behind that. We also have a crate on time and space and one called 13 Moons on a Turtle's Back, which looks at how Aboriginal people perceive time and space.
Rhonda, you've had a hand in putting a lot of this together. What is it that you've been trying to do?
Okay. As a teacher, I've been teaching for 7 years, I found that there was limited information for Aboriginal students in the area of science, and they didn't feel as comfortable in science as they did in the other subjects. So this was a way for me to help other educators in providing this type of crates for them. It made me realize as well how many things out in just ordinary things in everyday living that Native people have are scientifically based.
Well, let's look at this crate on structure. It's filled with all kinds of neat things. Let's pull some of them out and see what you have.
Well, the one that Anne was talking about, the teepee, we looked at that, and traditionally there's either three poles or four poles. So, and the scientific concept around that is stability over mass. And so the students try making a narrow one with the four poles and see if it stands. And they wrap it around with cellophane. And with the fan, they put it on and they see if it stands. And they realize that it doesn't. So they try to stretch out the poles over a round disc, so it's more stable. And again, they put the cellophane on, and they put the fan on, and they're amazed that it doesn't fall.
Let's look at a couple of these other crates. What's this one down here?
This would be 13 moons on a turtle's back.
Now, what does that mean?
13 moons on a turtle's back is in a Native community known as North America, and 13 moons is a calendar year. Mainstream is 12 months. In a Native community, it's 13 moons. And depending on the nation, the moons mean different things. And they're named after observations in the environment. It might be flying goose moon or a berry-picking moon. It all depends on the nation, I guess. And so that's the concept behind this.
Thank you very much, Anne.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Rhonda.
You're welcome.
I was speaking with Rhonda Elsner and Anne Popwell of the Science Alberta Foundation about the Aboriginal Science in a Crate program. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.